Welcome to the first sneak preview of Truth to Power. I recently did a phone interview with Dr. Jose Montoya. Because Dr. Montoya may currently be the most important chronic fatigue syndrome researcher, and because I think he says some newsworthy things in the interview, I'm releasing the entire phone conversation a week early. I think you'll be especially interested in hearing what he has to say about the contagiousness of chronic fatigue syndrome and a possible cause at the end of the interview. I hope you will come back next week and hear the entire program.
Hello, Dr. Montoya.
Yeah, hi, Charles.
Thank you for calling me and agreeing to be on my show. Before we get started, I just wanted to ask you, are you aware of the work that I did at my newspaper, New York Native? We covered chronic fatigue syndrome for 10 years from 1988 until 1997. And I had a reporter covering it on a weekly basis. I was just curious whether you are aware of that, or so you know my background.
I wasn't aware, Charles, and I apologize for that. I've been embedded too much into the work that we are doing here at the university, so I don't actually have the time, though I wish, to follow what transpires in the media.
That's okay. I just wanted to know, you know, what you know about me and what I've already done. And, you know, I published three books on chronic fatigue syndrome by a woman named Nina Ostrom. And she was our reporter, and she did a book called America's Biggest Cover-Up, about, you know, how serious chronic fatigue syndrome is. And it actually sold quite well. So I'm pretty familiar with the territory. I just wanted you to know that up front. So anyway, you've become one of the most beloved doctors and scientists in the field of chronic fatigue syndrome research. You've given patients hope because you've had some remarkable success in treating patients. You're also celebrated for your research showing that 17 cytokines are dysregulated in chronic fatigue syndrome. And you've given the world what looks like a very reliable test for chronic fatigue syndrome. And yet, many years ago, you were told you would end up homeless if you pursued chronic fatigue syndrome research. Are you afraid you could still end up on the street these days?
That's a great way to begin.
Go ahead.
It's great. Anything that is worthwhile in this life, and certainly in research, carries risk. And the higher what is at stake, the higher, like, for example, here was to bring down the dogma that this disease was a creation of the patient's imagination. That's what I was at stake, is bringing that dogma down. So the higher is at stake, the higher is the risk. And yes, I went against the advice of my beloved mentor, who I treasure still, when he said, you know, you are committing academic suicide. And look at that guy. We were in Paris at a meeting, and we were waiting for a taxi. And then he pointed to me to a guy who was really drunk with a bottle of wine in his hands and said, you're going to end up like that guy if you work on chronic fatigue syndrome. But it's really taking the risk. What makes our lives worthwhile, and, you know, as humans, is really that's it. And to me, that risk was worthwhile because of what it was at stake, also because the patients, they were so sick. What drew me into this was seeing the suffering in these patients. I couldn't put in my mind together a person with such an amazing life before the illness. And this is the story of all these patients. They have lives that are full of work and educational activities and joy and social life. And suddenly all that is brought down by the disease. So I couldn't put together the two.
But even lazy people can get chronic fatigue syndrome, right?
And I'm well, you know, what is being lazy, right?
So right. This is true.
In the United States, we have this horrible, you know, way of defining life by what we do, by our jobs. It's really the wrong way of defining life. I have to go to Europe every year for work, mostly France, and I love what they have there, where yes, there are jobs and yes, they have to get up every day, and but there is another notion, there's another way of seeing life. So anyway, so by United States standards, yes, lazy people do get chronopathy.
Well, let me ask you,
you are great. I'm enjoying this.
Great. Do you think chronic fatigue syndrome is a public health emergency?
It is, and it has been. I think that it exploded to epidemic proportions right at the same time where our beloved, other patients were being killed by the weak, by AIDS. So the two epidemics coincided in time, in the early 80s, and I think that was part of it, not to justify what was done to these MECFS patients.
I have so many questions for you about the relationship between those two, but we'll wait a little bit for those. I wanted to just ask, like, how many years have you been seeing patients with chronic fatigue syndrome?
13 years and 7 months. And
wow.
And it was, 13 years, 6 months, and 23 days.
Oh, that's and amazing.
2 hours. Okay. And 2 hours.
Boy, you're really keeping track. Are the patients of all ages?
Well, I have the limitation that I'm not a pediatrician, so I feel sad and bad that I don't have the skills to see, let's say, patients younger than, I don't feel responsible seeing patients younger than 14 or... and also the clinic at Stanford where we work has to be legally authorized to see children younger than that.
Okay.
So it's a limitation. It's my limitation.
How old is your oldest patient?
70 plus, 73.
Wow. And how long have they had the illness? Or do you recall?
From the oldest patients,
yes. It's
30 and 40. 30 years is... 40 years is the patient with the longest duration that I have seen.
Oh, wow. What percentage of your patients would you say are women?
75%.
Is chronic fatigue syndrome different in men?
It's possibly different. It brings the same suffering. It has the same devastation.
Right.
But it may be different in the way that, for example, there is a significant number of women who have their disease significantly worsened by the menstrual period, by the menstrual cycle. So obviously we will not see that in men. The other is that when women get pregnant and they have CFS, a third of them, the disease improves significantly during pregnancy. There is another third and nothing happens, and there is a third that gets worse. So there are biologically based factors that make the disease different in men than women. And I think I will add one more. I think the way women are treated in certain societies very unfairly,
right,
with lower opportunities, lower pay scales, that makes the disease worse for them.
Well, I've been wondering whether CFS is gradually being paradigmed as primarily a disease of women, and then that is having an effect on the willingness of men to even admit that they have chronic fatigue syndrome, and whether that the numbers are being skewed by that paradigm. Is that possible? Or
I think that that's possible. I don't have the data to prove that that's the case, but I will say that in both ways, that the sexist views that we have ingrained in our society, either overtly or subliminally or subconsciously, have made physicians, primarily males, but also females, to see female patients with ME/CFS as, more like, could this be part of their moods, part of their, a hysterical component. And that was the view, by the way, in the 1800s, and where there is some evidence that there was chronic fatigue syndrome, but they were viewed through those lenses.
Right.
So that's one thing. And then on the male side, yes, it will make it more difficult for males to accept that they have a disease that they cannot fight. And I don't know if there are really good studies, and we certainly don't have them, that if it takes longer for a male to reach a provider or a female, it looks like patients who have better socioeconomic status situation, they do reach the physician sooner. And that's part probably applies to any other diseases, but it's amplified for this disease because of the skepticism among providers about their symptoms. So yes, I think that there is a role there where the way women are viewed but it doesn't explain why we see more women with ME/CFS. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there are factors, barriers that women face that are different than men when they have the same illness.
You know, I'm very interested in the virus HHV6, and you know, my name is practically synonymous with the virus because my newspaper put that virus on the cover of my newspaper for 10 years. And I wanted to ask you, how much time have you spent actually studying that virus? Is that a big part of your work?
Yes, and I don't know how to quantitate the time spent on that, but I'm sure that that's not literally what you meant, but in the question, but you know, we still have a significant component of our efforts. So we, in that recent publication, we were fortunate as a teamwork. Everything that you see out of our group is teams, people, collaborators,
right?
Several brains brainstorming. This is not the product of a single investigator. And so in that, I hope that we have settled for good, for history, that this disease has an inflammatory component as their symptoms correlated with those 17 cytokines, and 13 of them were pro-inflammatory. But now we are trying to hunt. We are in a hunting process, literally, trying to find the triggers for that. What is perpetuating? What is triggering and what is perpetuating that inflammation? And HSV6 is a prime suspect, so still is there, very high.
Right.
But also, I have to share with you the other 7 herpes viruses.
Right.
Are also candidates, and we have been also fortunate by not only the research and the things that are coming out of our group, but there is a significant group of patients, Charles, that unequivocally they have been sick 5, 10, 20 plus years, and then they have tried numerous interventions, and when they start our treatment pointed interventions, that is followed by a gradual but ultimately dramatic recovery, like back to normal kind of recovery, and I think that the world is not appreciating this. People are not seeing it, and it's normal. It's expected that people keep writing there is no, you know, the disease is poorly understood. There are no treatments. That's fine that they keep writing that, but they are not appreciating this mini revolution that we are excited to be witnessing firsthand. And by the way, I'm sorry, but I didn't mean everybody, but a significant portion of our patients are having those dramatic recoveries. They are basically many of them going back to normal. Like that patient if you Google ABC News, chronic fatigue syndrome Montoya, there is one patient of ours who is now fully employee and going to study at night, and now is engaged with a fiance, and she's looking for a life with work, fun, babies, family.
Well, let me ask you this. In the patient that seems to be recovered, are the 17 cytokines that you identified as being dysregulated, are they suddenly all normal again in her?
That's a beautiful point. We haven't done that study. So that study gave us amazing insight into the illness. The next step is to have an assay that can be done in the clinic where we can do that, where we can say, this is your profile before treatment, and look at your profile after treatment. We have not done that, but that's the next step, and we are seeking for funding for that.
You know, I've started working my way through each one of those 17 cytokines and looking at what pathologies they're associated with. And first of all, the constellation of pathologies is kind of scary. Each one seems to be associated with something potentially very serious. Do you think that finding those 17 cytokines is going to help us paint a much clearer picture, you know, of the scope of this illness in a single patient? How, you know, what could happen to them? What is happening to them? That we're suddenly going to have a much better definition of what chronic fatigue syndrome is, because of where these cytokines are going to lead us.
Absolutely. And again, it's really great to talk to you. So there are several doors that are being opened with those findings, and you pointed to those. Not only understanding at a more one-to-one level, like this group of cytokines are likely responsible or are responsible for these specific symptoms in our patients who have been saying that all along. You know, the patients, the disease, ME/CFS has been whispering to us, pun intended, has been whispering to us what the disease is. It was not the disease not letting us see it. It was us with our deaf ears and narrow vision not being able to see it. So when those cytokines are found correlating with symptoms, yes, you start to say, you know, the patients complain of a lot of allergic symptoms, like hypersensitivity and reactions to drugs and to chemicals and to toxins. And IL-4, IL-5, IL-13, they are classic cytokines for allergic reactions. So no wonder why they have all this. But the other door that is open, and this is something that that only few are seeing it with the paper, but that was the intention of going to such a high impact journal. It was not fame or brownie points at our academic institution. It was because if you see the inflammation that is there, that is painted there with those cytokines, then immediately the next step is, what is the drug or the drugs that can counteract that inflammation? And then you could say, well, isn't that dangerous that you're going to try to treat the inflammation that is presented in those cytokines without knowing where it comes from? We do have that paradigm in other inflammatory diseases. Nobody knows what causes multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, systemic lupus erythematosus, lupus, and many other inflammatory diseases. Their cause, the etiology, is not known. Yet, we bring significant relief to those patients by treating that inflammation that they have, you know, in the different diseases. So we are presenting to the world a paradigm where, look at guys, this is the inflammation in this disease. Let's start to find the right drugs for that inflammation so we bring relief to them.
I wanted to ask you about chronic fatigue syndrome and cancer. Isn't dysregulation of some of those cytokines associated with an increased risk of cancer, of various forms of cancer?
Absolutely. Especially we are very excited. We're very excited about transforming growth factor beta, TGF-beta, one of the cytokines that is the only one of two that were found significantly different between cases and controls, just looking at the two groups. And that's what by far most investigators have done for 35 years, just comparing the cases with the healthy controls, period. And very few things have been found different. So, but that's one of the ones that was found different, TGF-beta. And TGF-beta, separate from ME/CFS research, completely separate from that, has been found to be a key cytokine for lymphoma, associated with lymphoma and lymphoma severity, like a cancer promoter. And lo and behold, we have this other separate data that points to in patients with ME/CFS, there is this higher risk of lymphoma. So we are proposing actually that this cytokine may be the link between ME/CFS immune dysregulation or inflammation and lymphoma.
Are you getting support from the National Cancer Institute because of this?
Not yet. We do have an investigator there who has approached us and who's working with us, and we're excited about it. But we don't have yet, specifics. So we are in conversations, correct.
Okay. I'd like to ask you about some of the statements of Nancy Klimas and Judy Mikovits, and you know both of these researchers, I believe.
Right. Yes.
Okay. In a paper in 1992, a group of scientists that included Nancy Klimas said that chronic fatigue syndrome is, quote, a form of acquired immunodeficiency. And you may also know that Judy Mikovits, who worked at the National Cancer Institute with one of Robert Gallo's colleagues, has called it and continues to call it non-HIV-AIDS. She says chronic fatigue syndrome is non-HIV-AIDS. I just was curious about your reaction to that.
Yes, I mean, let's just start with clinically.
Right.
So, as you know, my training is really in infectious diseases.
Right.
I took on CFS later, but I still practice infectious diseases. So, in the way of the opportunistic infections that we see associated with immunodeficiency, and in particular immunodeficiency that we see in AIDS, in that form of acquired immunodeficiency, clearly we don't see those opportunistic infections in ME/CFS patients. So if we go by the
none of them, let me stop you there. None, you see no opportunistic infections in chronic fatigue syndrome patients?
In the way that they're defined, and I know exactly what I'm coming from and what I'm talking about.
Right.
Not in the way that we define them in AIDS patients. So I'll give you examples. In AIDS patients, we see a form of pneumonia called pneumocystis jirovecchi or pneumocystis, formerly known as Carini pneumonia.
Right.
We see toxoplasmosis in their brains, MAC in their lymph nodes, CMV, cytomegalovirus, causing retinitis in their eyes. So I want to make sure that we have the same page, that we're on the same page, that we have the same level of information. So those opportunistic infections, exactly as I said it, as examples, I gave you pneumocystis, toxoplasmosis, mycobacterium avium complex, cytomegalovirus in the eye. Those infections are not seen in ME/CFS patients. And I have seen both populations. I have seen the AIDS patients when they were being killed by these horrible opportunistic infections.
Right.
I see today, like every year as part of my job at Stanford, to see cancer and transplant patients with those same opportunistic infections. ME/CFS patients do not have that. So
okay.
So you
have a list of differences between AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome. Do you also have a list of similarities between AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome?
Well, in the way that their immune system is dysfunctional, but for example, in AIDS, it's very clear that one of the key abnormalities is a depletion over a 10-year period of T cells that are CD3 positive, CD4 positive,
right.
The CD4 positive T cells that is depleted, over a decade period, and then they develop. This is in general, and then they develop these horrible opportunistic infections. We don't have a T cell depletion in ME/CFS patients.
Any alteration at all? Normal. They're perfectly normal.
No, I didn't say ME/CFS patients are normal.
Okay.
You are asking me if there were similarities, and I just cannot find things like the opportunistic infections, like the CD4 T cell depletion.
Is there any is there any depletion or any dysregulation of T4 cells in CFS?
There have been some reports, but it's not uniformly reported. It's not a homogeneous. One of the things that ME/CFS has suffered of is that because of limitations in funding, you tend to have reports in very small sample sizes, very small number of patients. So if you take 10, 20 patients and you do CD4s and you find a normality, can you really tell that that's, you will find that if you study 200 or 300 patients. Right. So the ME/CFS patients, a good number of them have depletion of natural killer cells, for example, called so-called NK cells. That has been reported relatively commonly. But in AIDS patients, that's not a key feature of their immunodeficiency.
There's no natural killer cell problem in AIDS?
Not in the way that the virus targets them, because they don't have the CD4 receptor. You do have some natural killer dysfunction as the overall system. The CD4 cells, so-called helper cells, are key to sustain the work of the immune system. So not only you drop the CD4 cells per se, but also the helpful function that they do to other cells. So if you are asking about like one-to-one defects, for me it's hard to put them together, but I am not denying that, for example, in HIV, despite that you control the virus and bring it to zero and their CD4 count goes back to normal and they leave. Now, these drugs started in 95, so they live 22 years or longer, because it's 22 years since we got those drugs, that they do have a significant inflammation. The HIV patients have a significant inflammation. And so, but the inflammation in them has not been defined the way we define the inflammation in MSCFS patients.
Well, let me stop you there to ask you this question. Did you test any AIDS patients for these 17 cytokines that are diagnostic for chronic fatigue syndrome?
No. That's what I said. No, there have been no studies. Like, our studies is unique, not just for ME/CFS patient, but it's for like any disease, because at the sample size we took almost 200 patients.
Right.
The number of cytokines we studied 51 on each of them. So it is an example of research, not just for ME/CFS, and that has not been done for HIV. But HIV really has not needed it. I hope that I'm not misunderstood when I said it's not needed, because they found the cause in 84. It was found that HIV was there. The first drug came in 85, AZT, and the cocktails came in December of 95 with the protease inhibitors.
Right. That's so, kind of that, you know, you like to use the word dogma. What you've just said is the AIDS dogma. So I'm just curious whether you're aware that people actually have questions about the AIDS dogma, or is that dogma that we should all believe? Is that dogma that should not be questioned?
And what is the AIDS dogma?
The dogma is that that HIV is the cause of AIDS, that HHV6 is not the cause of AIDS. And, you know, when one looks at AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome, one notices that they have this one virus in common, and it's called HHV6. You know, and if you look at the work of Connie Knox, it's very disturbing that it seems like HHV6 is doing all the work that HIV was supposed to be doing. But we're really not allowed to talk about HHV6 in AIDS because of the dogma.
But I mean, the dogma has to go, the need to not have dogmas has to go both ways. So,
right.
So I think you are presenting a position where HSV6 is the cause of AIDS.
Well, I know, but I'm wondering, you know, it's an open question. Is, you know, what is the role of HHV6 in AIDS? What is the role of HHV6 in chronic fatigue syndrome?
The role of HSV6 in AIDS, in my mind, has been settled by the experiments in simian models, where if you add HSV6 to HIV, to, in those cases, the simian immunodeficiency virus, SIV, there is a more rapid progression. So
yes,
HSV6 can precipitate the progression, but HSV6 is a virus that almost 100% of the population have, at least in the United States, and not 100% of the people in the United States has AIDS. So I think that to me, that this is totally my position, it doesn't mean that it's my dogma. I have to believe in data, and the data to me is compelling that if someone has a sexual relationship and they have no AIDS before and after the sexual relationship they have the HIV virus, you follow their CD4 counts, they go down. And if you do nothing, they develop the opportunistic infections. And if they do, then they die.
Okay, you've raised an interesting question about sexual transmission, and I have to ask you,
In patients who get the drugs,
right.
In patients who get the anti-HIV drugs that target specifically the HIV virus, all that is reversed. If there was a drug for HSV-6,
yes.
Reverse that, yes. Then I would be opening my mind to that possibility. But in these patients, the HIV drugs clearly reverse the immunodeficiency that is brought by the HIV virus.
Well, let's shift to a slightly different subject, which is sexual transmission of chronic fatigue syndrome. Is chronic fatigue syndrome a sexually transmissible illness?
In general, no.
No? So nobody has gotten chronic fatigue syndrome from their sexual partners?
I didn't say that. I said in general. In general, meaning I have couples that I follow over time,
right.
Discordant ones. One has CFS, the ME-CFS, the other one doesn't. They have intimate relation for decades, and the other partner doesn't develop it. And that's most of the times the situation. Occasionally, you see a patient who gets genital herpes,
right.
Not HSV-6, HSV-2, and following that, they develop the chronic fatigue syndrome. So, but that's the exception rather than the rule. So in my mind, again, and I'm open to data, not to opinions,
right.
What I see in my practice is that is not the classic disease for transmitted sexually.
Is it contagious? Is chronic fatigue syndrome a contagious illness?
It's the same idea. It's the same idea that occasionally you see someone who their disease started when they got a new partner. And occasionally we see the parent and then the daughter or their children developing the chronic fatigue syndrome. But there is new data that is about to come out from our group showing that there are certain genetic traits, certain genetic elements that predispose patients to have chronic fatigue syndrome. So I think it's the combination of an infectious agent combined with a genetic predisposition that leads to the disease, which will explain why people have herpes in many forms, including HSV-6, but only some develop the problem and others do not.
So you're saying under certain conditions, chronic fatigue syndrome is contagious?
Well, but you will have to share the same genetic predisposition. And that might explain why it's more common in families, for example.
So you don't think it could spread from one person in one family to another person in another family?
We don't see that. The one big question mark there is that there have been some outbreaks, but the outbreaks have been isolated and sporadic, like in LA, in North Carolina, in the UK, but we don't see those outbreaks happening every year or every 2 years with some periodicity. So I think it's a mix of how high is the inoculum of the pathogen, how much the person gets. That's well known in infectious diseases. It's supported by many experimental animal models. The more you give out the organism, the more severe is their immune response. And also, is the other factor is how is that immune response amplified by the genes of that individual?
So, if you were the head of the Centers for Disease Control, and you had to tell the American public about chronic fatigue syndrome, you would reassure them that it's not really a contagious illness.
It's not in the traditional terms.
It's untraditionally contagious.
No, it's not what I said.
Okay.
If a patient comes with tuberculosis in the clinic,
right.
We have to isolate them with respiratory measures. And then if a patient comes with a dripping discharge in their genitals, then we have to advise them that they could transmit that to others. And I don't see that here. I don't think that the ME/CFS patients need another stigmatizing feature to tell the people, for whoever becomes the head of the CDC, but for that person to tell people that this is contagious, and then set up a whole set of unnecessary, uncalled for panic, and stigmatize these patients further. They have enough stigma to give them another one.
But I mean, either it is contagious or it isn't contagious, right? It's not a matter of making people feel better about something.
No, but it's a matter of not giving them a stigma that is not reasonable, that is uncalled for. Why are we going to make them contagious when the data and years of seeing these patients in clinics clearly show that it's not? Now, if you ask the question, could it be transmitted through blood transfusion? That I don't know. And probably I would say we have no data to say it is or it's not. So blood transfusion should not be given by CFS patients. But for you to tell me that someone will need to say, based on what we know of the disease, that it could be contagious through respiratory means, contact, physical contact, or sexual contact, I don't think that's correct. And that's based on the data that I have. If someone has data to the contrary, I would love to see it, but that's unfair, that's unreasonable, and right now, 2017, is unscientific.
Well, I mean, the original, you know, the famous doctors in Incline Village, who you know, Paul Chaney and Dan Peterson, they both said it was obviously contagious when they were dealing with the outbreak there. Were they just crazy or wrong? Or
I think they were responding to the fact that there was an epidemic in their area. So right. They were right, cautious. They are great doctors. Have you asked them now if they think it's contagious at this level right now, at this stage? I don't think so. I don't think that Paul, I think he stopped seeing patients, but I don't think that when he was seeing patients, that he would be asking patients to wear a mask or to not have, contact, shake hands. So that's what we do here, at least if you're going to do it right. I mean, if you're going to say it's contagious, but you don't follow that with the right measures, you're really not doing anything other than stigmatizing the patients. But here at Stanford or any well-regarded hospital, if you say that something is contagious through the respiratory route, we have a series of measures, and depending on how is the level of contagiousness, you have to institute them, from a mask and what type of mask, to a gown, to gloves, etc. That not applies to ME/CFS patients as far as I know.
Well, you know, it's interesting because your test for 17 cytokines could now be given to everyone working in a hospital. And you could actually track the progression of the illness if it actually were to spread, among healthcare workers. You follow my logic here that you in a way have now provided
not,
a way.
It's not the right thing to do. It's not the right. You don't do tests to people who are healthy. That's not a good way to spend health resources, and that's not good medicine.
But don't you want to know? If I were a nurse or a doctor,
if the person
you're asking,
is healthy,
you're asking
if the
nurses
person
and doctors,
is healthy, you do not do tests to them. If you are a healthy person, you do not. That's the wrong way to spend health resources that are so scarce these days, and for the healthcare system in the United States, which is completely wrong, and it's costing north of $1 trillion. That would be the wrong way to go.
But how do you protect? How do you prove to nurses and doctors who you're asking to work with chronic fatigue syndrome patients that they're not going to wake up someday with 17 cytokines that are dysregulated because they've worked with chronic fatigue syndrome patients? I mean, shouldn't they at least be, warned that, this is potentially, under certain circumstances, as you say, a transmissible or contagious illness? I mean, from a public health point of view, most healthcare workers are always concerned about, contracting illnesses from the patients they care for. We know that from the AIDS epidemic. I mean, are they being sort of left in the dark about what's really happening with chronic fatigue syndrome?
It's not contagious for the history that we have and the epidemiology and the principles of that are applied to contagious illnesses should not be applied to ME/CFS patients. And please feel free. I mean, that's what I can tell you based on what I know and what I have seen and what I have studied, but always feel free to ask other people. You're not going to get me to say that it's contagious. That's not what the data supports.
I mean, would you be shocked if the data starts to support that? Would that be
But where is the data? I mean, I've seen patients for 13 years, and I shake their hands, and I give them a hug, and I examine them, and I open their mouths, and so this is not a good way to help these patients, and to say that they are contagious. My God, that would be so devastating. Without any data, that's not the right thing to do.
Well, you read Hillary Johnson's book, Ulcers Web. There's quite a few pages in that book devoted to the transmission and in families, in schools, in orchestras, and on airlines. And she really does almost shoe leather, what could be called CDC shoe leather epidemiology, the kind of epidemiology the CDC did not do. You can find in her book, and I am aware that you've read her book. I think you admire her book, as a matter of fact. But you can't read her book without getting the solid impression that chronic fatigue syndrome is transmissible and contagious. I mean, it's not the craziest idea. I mean, it's like, for some people, it's just a given.
No, exactly. I already said that, and I alluded to the outbreaks. I mentioned the North Carolina, which is the symphony orchestra. So I don't know how else to tell you that those outbreaks. I mentioned the inoculum effect. I mentioned the genetics. I mentioned the possibility of concurrent infections, but that's not what I see in the disease overall.
Just a couple more quick things, Dr. Montoya. I've known several women with chronic fatigue syndrome, and they swear they know who they got it from, that they got it from a sexual partner. And they also are aware of the sexual partner's health issues, and often that sexual partner has similar health problems. So, I mean, you must be hearing this from some of your patients. Do none of your patients not say, you know, Dr. Montoya, you know, I think I got it from this relationship I had.
I mentioned to you already uh-huh. that there are instances where the patient says that they have a new sexual partner, and that's where the disease begins. And even more, they get genital herpes 2, not HSV6, genital herpes 2, and then the disease begins there. And then when we suppress the genital herpes 2, the symptoms abate. When they are, it's not just suppressing the virus, but they have to adjust their life while they're recovering and have some lifestyle choices. But the drug clearly leads to a full recovery. I said that is there, but that doesn't make CFS a classic sexually transmitted infection or disease.
So you don't warn any of your patients that they could give CFS to their future sexual partners?
No.
Okay. One last question, and you've given me more time than I even expected you to give me. I'm very grateful. I wanted just to go over the 17 cytokine thing again in terms of AIDS. If you were to find those exact 17 cytokines dysregulated in AIDS, would you be surprised? Would it mean anything to you, or would it be of just no interest? I'm just curious about that.
No, it would be fascinating to find them. You haven't, I think, asked the right question about AIDS versus CFS, but because I think that there is the potential of a third player in ME-CFS. It's not for sure HIV, but it could be a third pathogen that could share the characteristics of HIV, could be one that shares the characteristic of herpes viruses, could be a chimeric form of the two, like in an area of the Hillary Johnson's book is nicely described. So I haven't said that it's not that, but it doesn't mean that it's transmissible through physical, skin, respiratory, sexual contact, because there are compartments in humans that are not accessible to either testing, that are easily accessible through testing, or that are not readily available for contact transmission. So I think that you are asking, this is my humble opinion, you are asking the wrong questions about AIDS versus CFS. So I don't see any evidence that it's a human immunodeficiency virus, that is a retrovirus in the way that is transmissible easily through contact surfaces or blood or sexual secretions. I don't see the evidence for that, but I haven't said that there is no possibility that something similar can be in a body compartment, that when a major infectious load gets to the patient, that can be reactivated and that could trigger and perpetuate chronic fatigue syndrome. And we are looking for such an agent.
Have you made any progress?
We are looking for it. I said we are looking for it.
I have to ask one last question, which is, what about the role of endogenous retroviruses?
No, that's what I was referring to.
Like HERV-K18, which is induced by HHV6, acts as a superantigen. Right. Is that something you're at all interested in? Or?
Yes. We are looking for that or something like that. Correct. Oh, but that doesn't make endogenous retroviruses, doesn't make, if we ultimately find that, and I'm collaborating with another group at Stanford, whose their primary interest is another disease where they found inflammation and they found endogenous retrovirus as the trigger of the inflammation for that disease. And so I am very aware, and we are in that lead. We're following that lead. But that's a completely separate story. Putting endogenous retroviruses, the same implications clinically and epidemiological as HIV, I'm sorry, it's crazy. It's ignorance, because it's completely different territory. So yes, we are looking for endogenous retroviruses. Yes, we are looking for another pathogen. Yes, we're looking for HSV6, for an unknown pathogen. And the novelty in what we are trying to do, because we believe that people try hard, but they couldn't find it, is going to compartments that people have not been tapped before. They have not been explored before.
Right.
And I think that that's where we may strike goal is by going to those areas, to those places. Right. But that, if we find in those places, it will explain why it's not contagious. But it could explain why in certain groups, suddenly everything, several people reactivate those areas.
Dr. Montoya, I have to thank you for the most interesting interview I think I've ever conducted in my life.
Well, can I tell you something?
Yes.
This is the most interested interviewer and interview that I have had in my life as well.
Well, then I hope that means you will do it again. And there's going to be a lot more to talk about in the coming years because of your work. So thank you again.
And I trust you, because you've come across extremely smart and well supported. Don't misquote me, please.
I won't.
And because then I'll be happy to do this again. Yes.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Take care, Charles.
Bye.
Bye.
I hope you found that interview interesting and thought-provoking. If you like what I'm doing at Truth to Power, please buy a copy of one of my books at charlesortleb.com. You'll be amazed how affordable we've made the Kindle versions of my books. See you next week.